Chapter 3. Arguments for God's Existence.
A professorship of theology should have no place in our institution. Thomas Jefferson.
The five proofs asserted by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century don't prove anything, and are easily, though I hesitate to say so given his eminence, exposed as vacuous. The first three are just different ways of saying the same thing, and they can be considered together. All involve an infinite regress. The answer to a question raises a prior question, and so on ad infinitum. For example, Aquinas's first proof...
The unmoved mover. Nothing moves without a prior mover. This leads us to a regress, from which the only escape is God. Something had to make the first move, and that something we call God.
All three of these arguments rely upon the idea of a regress, and invoke God to terminate it. They make the entirely unwarranted assumption that God himself is immune to the regress. Even if we allow the dubious luxury of arbitrarily conjuring up a terminator to an infinite regress and giving it a name, simply because we need one, there is absolutely no reason to endow that terminator with any of the properties normally ascribed to God: omnipotence, omniscience, goodness, creativity of design, to say nothing of such human attributes as listening to prayers, forgiving sins, and reading innermost thoughts. It is more parsimonious to conjure up, say, a Big Bang singularity or some other physical concept as yet unknown. Calling it God is at best unhelpful and at worst perniciously misleading. Edward Lear's nonsense recipe for crumbobbleous cutlets invites us to
procure some strips of beef, and having cut them into the smallest possible pieces, proceed to cut them still smaller, 8 or perhaps 9 times.
Some regresses do reach a natural terminator. Scientists used to wonder what would happen if you could dissect, say, gold, into the smallest possible pieces. Why shouldn't you cut one of those pieces in half and produce an even smaller smidgen of gold? The regress in this case is decisively terminated by the atom. The smallest possible piece of gold is a nucleus consisting of exactly 79 protons and a slightly larger number of neutrons, attended by a swarm of 79 electrons. If you cut gold any further than the level of the single atom, whatever else you get, it is not gold. The atom provides a natural terminator to the crumbobbleous cutlets type of regress. It is by no means clear that God provides a natural terminator to the regresses of Aquinas. That's putting it mildly, as we shall see later. Let's move on down Aquinas's list.
The argument from degree. We notice that things in the world differ. There are degrees of, say, goodness or perfection. But we judge these degrees only by comparison with a maximum. Humans can be both good and bad, so the maximum goodness cannot rest in us. Therefore, there must be some other maximum to set the standard for perfection, and we call that maximum God.
That's an argument. You might as well say people vary in smelliness, but we can make the comparison only by reference to a perfect maximum of conceivable smelliness. Therefore, there must exist a preeminently peerless stinker, and we call him God. Or substitute any dimension of comparison you like, and derive an equally fatuous conclusion.
The teleological argument, or argument from design. Things in the world, especially living things, look as though they have been designed. Nothing we know looks designed unless it is designed. Therefore, there must have been a designer, and we call him God.
Aquinas himself used the analogy of an arrow moving towards a target, but a modern heat-seeking anti-aircraft missile would have suited his purpose better. The argument from design is the only one still in regular use today, and it still sounds to many like the ultimate knock-down argument. The young Darwin was impressed by it when, as a Cambridge undergraduate, he read it in William Paley's Natural Theology. Unfortunately for Paley, the mature Darwin blew it out of the water. There has probably never been a more devastating rout of popular belief by clever reasoning than Charles Darwin's destruction of the argument from design. It was so unexpected. Thanks to Darwin, it is no longer true to say that nothing that we know looks designed unless it is designed. Evolution, by natural selection, produces an excellent simulacrum of design, mounting prodigious heights of complexity and elegance. The ontological argument and other a priori arguments. Arguments for God's existence fall into two main categories, the a priori and the a posteriori. Thomas Aquinas's five are a posteriori arguments, relying upon inspection of the world. The most famous of the a priori arguments, those that rely upon pure armchair ratiocination, is the ontological argument, proposed by St. Anselm of Canterbury in 1078 and restated in different forms by numerous philosophers ever since. It is possible to conceive, Anselm said, of a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. Even an atheist can conceive of such a superlative being, though he would deny its existence in the real world. But, goes the argument, a being that doesn't exist in the real world is, by that very fact, less than perfect. Therefore we have a contradiction, and hey presto, God exists. Let me translate this infantile argument into the appropriate language, which is the language of the playground.
Bet you I can prove God exists.
Bet you can't.
Right then, imagine the most perfect, perfect, perfect thing possible.
Okay, now what?
Now, is that perfect, perfect, perfect thing real? Does it exist?
No, it's only in my mind.
But if it was real, it would be even more perfect, because a really, really perfect thing would have to be better than a silly old imaginary thing. So I've proved that God exists. Na, 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 na. All atheists are fools.
I had my childish wiseacre choose the word fools advisedly. Anselm himself quoted the first verse of Psalm 14. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And he had the cheek to use the name fool, Latin incipiens, for his hypothetical atheist.
Hence, even the fool is convinced that something exists in the understanding, at least, than which nothing greater can be conceived. For when he hears of this, he understands it. And whatever is understood exists in the understanding. And assuredly that, than which nothing greater can be conceived, cannot exist in the understanding alone. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater.
The most definitive refutations of the ontological argument are usually attributed to the philosophers David Hume, 1711-76, and Immanuel Kant, 1724-1804. Kant identified the trick card up Anselm's sleeve as his slippery assumption that existence is more perfect than non-existence. The American philosopher Norman Malcolm put it like this.
The doctrine that existence is a perfection is remarkably queer. It makes sense and is true to say that my future house will be a better one if it is insulated than if it is not insulated, but what could it mean to say that it will be a better house if it exists than if it does not?
The existence or non-existence of God is too big a question to be decided by dialectical prestidigitation. And I don't think the slippery use of existence as an indicator of perfection is the worst of the argument's problems. The ontological argument, like all a priori arguments for the existence of God, reminds me of the old man in Aldous Huxley's Point Counterpoint, who discovered a mathematical proof of the existence of God.
You know the formula m over naught equals infinity, m being any positive number? Well, why not reduce the equation to a simpler form by multiplying both sides by naught, in which case you have m equals infinity times naught. That is to say that a positive number is the product of zero and infinity. Doesn't that demonstrate the creation of the universe by an infinite power out of nothing? Doesn't it?
Or there is the notorious 18th century debate on the existence of God, staged by Catherine the Great, between Euler, the Swiss mathematician, and Diderot, the great encyclopedist of the Enlightenment. The pious Euler advanced upon the atheistic Diderot, and in tones of the utmost conviction delivered his challenge. Monsieur, A plus B to the N over N equals X. Therefore God exists. Reply! Diderot was cowed into withdrawal, and one version of the story has him withdrawing all the way back to France. Even I, with my long experience, have never encountered an argument like that. I have, however, met many of the wonderful proofs collected at the website, Over 300 Proofs of God's Existence. Here's a hilarious trio, beginning with proof number 36. Argument from Incomplete Devastation. A plane crashed, killing 143 passengers and crew, but one child survived with only third-degree burns, therefore God exists.
37. Argument from Possible Worlds. If things had been different, then things would be different. That would be bad. Therefore God exists.
38. Argument from Sheer Will. I do believe in God. I do believe in God. I do, I do, I do, I do believe in God. Therefore God exists. The argument from Beauty. Another character in the Aldous Huxley novel just mentioned proved the existence of God by playing Beethoven's String Quartet No. 15 in A minor, Heiliger Dankgesang, on a gramophone. Unconvincing as that sounds, it does represent a popular strand of argument. I've given up counting the number of times I receive the more or less truculent challenge, "How do you account for Shakespeare, then?" Substitute Schubert, Michelangelo, etc., to taste. The argument will be so familiar I needn't document it further, but the logic behind it is never spelled out, and the more you think about it, the more vacuous you realize it to be. Obviously Beethoven's late quartets are sublime. So are Shakespeare's sonnets. They are sublime if God is there, and they are sublime if he isn't. They do not prove the existence of God, they prove the existence of Beethoven and of Shakespeare. A great conductor is credited with saying, "If you have Mozart to listen to, why would you need God?" I once was the guest of the week on the BBC radio show Desert Island Discs. You have to choose the 8 records you would take with you if marooned on a desert island. Among my choices was Mache dich mein Herze rein, from Bach's St. Matthew Passion. The interviewer was unable to understand how I could choose religious music without being religious. You might as well say, how can you enjoy Wuthering Heights when you know perfectly well that Cathy and Heathcliff never really existed? But there is an additional point that I might have made, and which needs to be made whenever religion is given credit for, say, the Sistine Chapel or Raphael's Annunciation. Even great artists have to earn a living, and they will take commissions where they are to be had. I have no reason to doubt that Raphael and Michelangelo were Christians. It was pretty much the only option in their time. But the fact is almost incidental. Its enormous wealth had made the church the dominant patron of the arts. If history had worked out differently, and Michelangelo had been commissioned to paint a ceiling for a giant museum of science, mightn't he have produced something at least as inspirational as the Sistine Chapel? How sad that we shall never hear Beethoven's Mesozoic Symphony, or Mozart's opera The Expanding Universe. And what a shame that we are deprived of Haydn's Evolution Oratorio. But that does not stop us from enjoying his creation. To approach the argument from the other side, what if, as my wife chillingly suggests to me, Shakespeare had been obliged to work to commission from the church? We'd surely have lost Hamlet, King Lear, and Macbeth. And what would we have gained in return? Such stuff as dreams are made on? Dream on.
If there is a logical argument linking the existence of great art to the existence of God, it is not spelled out by its proponents. It's simply assumed to be self-evident, which it most certainly is not. Maybe it is to be seen as yet another version of the argument from Design. Schubert's musical brain is a wonder of improbability, even more so than the vertebrate eye. Or, more ignobly, perhaps it's a sort of jealousy of genius. How dare another human being make such beautiful music, poetry, art, when I can't? It must be God that did it.
The argument from personal experience. One of the cleverer and more mature of my undergraduate contemporaries, who was deeply religious, went camping in the Scottish Isles. In the middle of the night, he and his girlfriend were woken in their tent by the voice of the devil, Satan himself. There could be no possible doubt. The voice was in every sense diabolical. My friend would never forget this horrifying experience, and it was one of the factors that later drove him to be ordained. My youthful self was impressed by his story, and I recounted it to a gathering of zoologists relaxing in the Rose and Crown Inn, Oxford. Two of them happened to be experienced ornithologists, and they roared with laughter. "Manx Shearwater," they shouted in delighted chorus. One of them added that the diabolical shrieks and cackles of this species have earned it, in various parts of the world and various languages, the local nickname Devil Bird. Many people believe in God because they believe they have seen a vision of him, or of an angel or a virgin in blue, with their own eyes, or he speaks to them inside their heads. This argument from personal experience is the one that is most convincing to those who claim to have had one, but it is the least convincing to anyone else, and anyone knowledgeable about psychology. You say you have experienced God directly? Well, some people have experienced a pink elephant, but that probably doesn't impress you. Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, distinctly heard the voice of Jesus telling him to kill women, and he was locked up for life. George W. Bush says that God told him to invade Iraq. A pity God didn't vouchsafe him a revelation that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Individuals in asylums think they are Napoleon or Charlie Chaplin, or that the entire world is conspiring against them, or that they can broadcast their thoughts into other people's heads. We humour them, but don't take their internally revealed beliefs seriously, mostly because not many people share them. Religious experiences are different only in that the people who claim them are numerous. Sam Harris was not being overly cynical when he wrote in The End of Faith,
"We have names for people who have many beliefs for which there is no rational justification. When their beliefs are extremely common, we call them religious. Otherwise, they are likely to be called mad, psychotic, or delusional. Clearly, there is sanity in numbers. And yet it is merely an accident of history that it is considered normal in our society to believe that the creator of the universe can hear your thoughts, while it is demonstrative of mental illness to believe that he is communicating with you by having the rain tap in Morse code on your bedroom window. And so, while religious people are not generally mad, their core beliefs absolutely are."
The human brain runs first-class simulation software. Our eyes don't present to our brains a faithful photograph of what is out there, or an accurate movie of what is going on through time. Our brains construct a continuously updated model, updated by coded pulses chattering along the optic nerve, but constructed nevertheless. Optical illusions are vivid reminders of this. I have on my windowsill a plastic mask of Einstein. When seen from the front, it looks like a solid face, not surprisingly. What is surprising is that when seen from behind, the hollow side, it also looks like a solid face, and our perception of it is very odd indeed. As the viewer moves around, the face seems to follow, and not in the weak, unconvincing sense that the Mona Lisa's eyes are said to follow you. The hollow mask really, really looks as though it is moving. People who haven't previously seen the illusion gasp with amazement. Even stranger, if the mask is mounted on a slowly rotating turntable, it appears to turn in the correct direction when you are looking at the solid side, but in the opposite direction when the hollow side comes into view. The result is that when you watch the transition from one side to the other, the coming side appears to eat the going side. It is a stunning illusion, well worth going to some trouble to see. Sometimes you can get surprisingly close to the hollow face and still not see that it is really hollow. When you do see it, again there is a sudden flip, which may be reversible.
Why does it happen? There is no trick in the construction of the mask. Any hollow mask will do it. The trickery is all in the brain of the beholder. The internal simulating software receives data indicating the presence of a face, perhaps nothing more than a pair of eyes, a nose and a mouth in approximately the right places. Having received these sketchy clues, the brain does the rest. The face simulation software kicks into action and it constructs a fully solid model of a face, even though the reality presented to the eyes is a hollow mask. This is all just to demonstrate the formidable power of the brain's simulation software. It is well capable of constructing visions and visitations of the utmost veridical power. To simulate a ghost or an angel or a Virgin Mary would be child's play to software of this sophistication. And the same thing works for hearing. When we hear a sound, it is not faithfully transported up the auditory nerve and relayed to the brain as if by a high-fidelity Bang & Olufsen. As with vision, the brain constructs a sound model based upon continuously updated auditory nerve data.
Once, as a child, I heard a ghost, a male voice murmuring as if in recitation or prayer. I could almost but not quite make out the words, which seemed to have a serious, solemn timbre. I'd been told stories of priest holes in ancient houses, and I was a little frightened, but I got out of bed and crept up on the source of the sound. As I got closer, it grew louder, and then suddenly it flipped inside my head. I was now close enough to discern what it really was. The wind, gusting through the keyhole, was creating sounds which the simulation software in my brain had used to construct a model of male speech, solemnly intoned. Had I been a more impressionable child, it is possible that I would have heard not just unintelligible speech, but particular words and even sentences. And had I been both impressionable and religiously brought up, I wonder what words the wind might have spoken. On another occasion, when I was about the same age, I saw a giant round face gazing with unspeakable malevolence out through the window of an otherwise ordinary house in a seaside village. In trepidation I approached until I was close enough to see what it really was, just a vaguely face-like pattern created by the chance fall of the curtains. The face itself and its evil mien had been constructed in my fearful child's brain. On the 11th of September 2001, pious people thought they saw the face of Satan in the smoke rising from the Twin Towers, a superstition backed by a photograph which was published on the internet and widely circulated.
Constructing models is something the human brain is very good at. When we are asleep, it is called dreaming. When we are awake, we call it imagination, or when it is exceptionally vivid, hallucination. Children who have imaginary friends sometimes see them clearly, exactly as if they were real. If we are gullible, we don't recognize hallucination or lucid dreaming for what it is, and we claim to have seen or heard a ghost or an angel or God, or, especially if we happen to be young, female and Catholic, the Virgin Mary. Such visions and manifestations are certainly not good grounds for believing that ghosts or angels, gods or virgins, are actually there.
On the face of it, mass visions, such as the report that 70,000 pilgrims at Fatima in Portugal in 1917 saw the sun tear itself from the heavens and come crashing down upon the multitude, are harder to write off. It is not easy to explain how 70,000 people could share the same hallucination. But it is even harder to accept that it really happened without the rest of the world outside Fatima seeing it too, and not just seeing it, but feeling it as the catastrophic destruction of the solar system, including acceleration forces sufficient to hurl everybody into space. David Hume's pithy test for a miracle comes irresistibly to mind.
No testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavours to establish.
It may seem improbable that 70,000 people could simultaneously be deluded, or could simultaneously collude in a mass lie, or that history is mistaken in recording that 70,000 people claimed to see the sun dance, or that they all simultaneously saw a mirage. They had been persuaded to stare at the sun, which can't have done much for their eyesight. But any of those apparent improbabilities is far more probable than the alternative, that the Earth was suddenly yanked sideways in its orbit and the solar system destroyed, with nobody outside Fatima noticing. I mean, Portugal is not that isolated.
Although admittedly my parents once stayed in a Paris hotel called L'Hôtel de l'Univers et du Portugal.
That is really all that needs to be said about personal experiences of gods or other religious phenomena. If you've had such an experience, you may well find yourself believing firmly that it was real. But don't expect the rest of us to take your word for it, especially if we have the slightest familiarity with the brain and its powerful workings. The argument from Scripture. there are still some people who are persuaded by scriptural evidence to believe in God. A common argument attributed among others to C.S. Lewis, who should have known better, states that, since Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, he must have been either right or else insane or a liar, mad, bad, or God, or, with artless alliteration, lunatic, liar, or lord. The historical evidence that Jesus claimed any sort of divine status is minimal, but even if that evidence were good, the trilemma on offer would be ludicrously inadequate. A fourth possibility, almost too obvious to need mentioning, is that Jesus was honestly mistaken. Plenty of people are. In any case, as I said, there is no good historical evidence that he ever thought he was divine.
The fact that something is written down is persuasive to people not used to asking questions like, who wrote it and when? How did they know what to write? Did they in their time really mean what we in our time understand them to be saying? Were they unbiased observers, or did they have an agenda that coloured their writing? Ever since the 19th century, scholarly theologians have made an overwhelming case that the Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the history of the real world. All were written long after the death of Jesus, and also after the epistles of Paul, which mention almost none of the alleged facts of Jesus' life. All were then copied and recopied through many different Chinese whispers generations, by fallible scribes who in any case had their own religious agendas.
A good example of the colouring by religious agendas is the whole heartwarming legend of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, followed by Herod's massacre of the innocents. When the Gospels were written many years after Jesus' death, nobody knew where he was born. But an Old Testament prophecy, Micah 5:2, had led Jews to expect that the long-awaited Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. In the light of this prophecy, John's Gospel specifically remarks that his followers were surprised that he was not born in Bethlehem.
Others said, "This is the Christ." But some said, "Shall Christ come out of Galilee? Hath not the Scripture said that Christ cometh of the seed of David and out of the town of Bethlehem where David was?"
Matthew and Luke handle the problem differently, by deciding that Jesus must have been born in Bethlehem after all. But they get him there by different routes. Matthew has Mary and Joseph in Bethlehem all along, moving to Nazareth only long after the birth of Jesus, on their return from Egypt, where they fled from King Herod and the massacre of the innocents. Luke, by contrast, acknowledges that Mary and Joseph lived in Nazareth before Jesus was born. So how to get them to Bethlehem at the crucial moment, in order to fulfill the prophecy? Luke says that in the time when Quirinius, was governor of Syria, Caesar Augustus decreed a census for taxation purposes, and everybody had to go to his own city. Joseph was of the house and lineage of David, and therefore he had to go to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem. That must have seemed like a good solution, except that historically it is complete nonsense. David, if he existed, lived nearly 1,000 years before Mary and Joseph. Why on earth would the Romans have required Joseph to go to the city where a remote ancestor had lived a millennium earlier? It is as though I were required to specify, say, Ashby de la Zouche as my hometown on a census form, if it happened that I could trace my ancestry back to the Seigneur de Dacaine, who came over with William the Conqueror and settled there.
Moreover, Luke screws up his dating by tactlessly mentioning events that historians are capable of independently checking. There was indeed a census under Governor Quirinius, a local census, not one decreed by Caesar Augustus for the empire as a whole, but it happened too late, in AD 6, long after Herod's death. Sophisticated Christians do not need George Gershwin to convince them that the things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. But there are many unsophisticated Christians out there who think it absolutely is necessarily so, who take the Bible very seriously indeed as a literal and accurate record of history, and hence as evidence supporting their religious beliefs. Do these people never open the book that they believe is the literal truth? Why don't they notice those glaring contradictions? Shouldn't a literalist worry about the fact that Matthew traces Joseph's descent from King David via 28 intermediate generations, while Luke has 41 generations? Worse, there is almost no overlap in the names on the two lists. In any case, if Jesus really was born of a virgin, Joseph's ancestry is irrelevant and cannot be used to fulfil, on Jesus' behalf, the Old Testament prophecy that the Messiah should be descended from David.
The four Gospels that made it into the official canon were chosen, more or less arbitrarily, out of a larger sample of at least a dozen, including the Gospels of Thomas, Peter, Nicodemus, Philip, Bartholomew, and Mary Magdalene. The Gospel of Thomas, for example, has numerous anecdotes about the child Jesus abusing his magical powers in the manner of a mischievous fairy, impishly transforming his playmates into goats or turning mud into sparrows. It will be said that nobody believes crude miracle stories such as those in the Gospel of Thomas anyway. But there is no more and no less reason to believe the four canonical Gospels. All have the status of legends, as factually dubious as the stories of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table.
Most of what the four canonical Gospels share is derived from a common source, either Mark's Gospel or a lost work of which Mark is the earliest extant descendant. Nobody knows who the four evangelists were, but they almost certainly never met Jesus personally. Much of what they wrote was in no sense an honest attempt at history, but was simply rehashed from the Old Testament, because the Gospel makers were devoutly convinced that the life of Jesus must fulfil Old Testament prophecies.
Reputable biblical scholars do not in general regard the New Testament, and obviously not the Old Testament, as a reliable record of what actually happened in history, and I shall not consider the Bible further as evidence for any kind of deity.
Pascal's Wager. The great French mathematician Blaise Pascal reckoned that however long the odds against God's existence might be, there is an even larger asymmetry in the penalty for guessing wrong. You'd better believe in God, because if you are right, you stand to gain eternal bliss, and if you are wrong, it won't make any difference anyway. On the other hand, if you don't believe in God and you turn out to be wrong, you get eternal damnation, whereas if you are right, it makes no difference. On the face of it, the decision is a no-brainer. Believe in God.
There is something distinctly odd about the argument, however. Believing is not something you can decide to do as a matter of policy. At least it's not something I can decide to do as an act of will. I can decide to go to church, and I can decide to recite the Nicene Creed, and I can decide to swear on a stack of Bibles that I believe every word inside them. But none of that can make me actually believe it if I don't. Pascal's wager could only ever be an argument for feigning belief in God. And the God that you claim to believe in had better not be of the omniscient kind, or he'd see through the deception. The ludicrous idea that believing is something you can decide to do is deliciously mocked by Douglas Adams in Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, where we meet the robotic electric monk, a labour-saving device that you buy to do your believing for you. The deluxe model is advertised as capable of believing things they wouldn't believe in Salt Lake City.
But why, in any case, do we so readily accept the idea that the one thing you must do if you want to please God is believe in him? What's so special about believing? Isn't it just as likely that God would reward kindness or generosity or humility or sincerity? What if God is a scientist who regards honest seeking after truth as the supreme virtue? Indeed, wouldn't the designer of the universe have to be a scientist? Bertrand Russell was asked what he would say if he died and found himself confronted by God, demanding to know why Russell had not believed in him. "Not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence," was Russell's immortal reply. Mightn't God respect Russell for his courageous scepticism, let alone for the courageous pacifism that landed him in prison in the First World War, far more than he would respect Pascal for his cowardly bet-hedging? And while we cannot know which way God would jump, we don't need to know in order to refute Pascal's wager. We are talking about a bet, remember, and Pascal wasn't claiming that his wager enjoyed anything but very long odds. Would you bet on God's valuing dishonestly faked belief, or even honest belief, over honest scepticism?
Then again, suppose the God who confronts you when you die turns out to be Baal, and suppose Baal is just as jealous as his old rival Yahweh was said to be. Mightn't Pascal have been better off wagering on no god at all, rather than on the wrong god? Indeed, doesn't the sheer number of potential gods and goddesses on whom one might bet vitiate Pascal's whole logic? Pascal was probably joking when he promoted his wager, just as I'm joking in my dismissal of it. But I have encountered people, for example, in the question session after a lecture, who have seriously advanced Pascal's wager as an argument in favour of believing in God, so it was right to give it a brief airing here. Is it possible, finally, to argue for a sort of anti-Pascal wager? Suppose we grant that there is indeed some small chance that God exists. Nevertheless, it could be said that you will lead a better, fuller life if you bet on his not existing than if you bet on his existing, and therefore squander your precious time on worshipping him, sacrificing to him, fighting and dying for him, etc. I won't pursue the question here, but readers might like to bear it in mind when we come to later chapters on the evil consequences that can flow from religious belief and observance.